I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Larry Killam. He is a retired engineer and high-tech entrepreneur. He will be leading a student discussion called Fracking, the Monster in Our Backyard. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, first of all, fracking stands for hydraulic fracturing. It's a way of getting natural gas out of hard-to-reach places deep, deep in the ground. What's your background in this subject?
Well, my background is I'm trained as an engineer, and I've worked in most of my career in plastics and polymer machinery and instrumentation. And my customers were the oil companies like Exxon, who make polymers and plastics, and they're we call the downstream.
Right.
After I moved out of that field, here in Santa Fe, I started a company where we manufactured environmental monitoring instruments. A lot of it was for pollution created by oil and gas industry. In addition, I have several relatives who are very much in the industry. A son in Houston who just retired from Shell Oil in their exploration division. A nephew also in Houston who is starting out very well with British Gas, working all over the world in their exploration and shipping. And I have a cousin in Denver who explores and drills for oil primarily in the Dakotas.
So you are very much what we outsiders might call an insider in this whole oil and gas industry, and yet you're calling fracking a monster. Why?
Well, I'm calling fracking as a monster. Partially it's an emotional term to jar us into thinking about its immense implications. And particularly immense, let's say, in New Mexico compared to, say, North Carolina or somewhere. It's a very big industry in New Mexico and promises to get a lot larger.
And why is that?
Well, it's because New Mexico is blessed with a lot of oil and gas resources. It's number two in the country in underground gas.
And so getting the gas out of the ground, I mean, it's basically, if my understanding is correct, and you can tell us more about this, the low-hanging fruit is long gone, and now we have to dig much deeper and get the much more difficult to access gas if we're going to get it out of the ground.
Exactly. Typically, with fracking, we're going down a mile or more in depth.
And why is it called fracking? What is it? Describe this process.
What we're doing is fracturing the rock to release the gas and oil. They come up together. You can't get them separated. And it's done at extremely high pressure. You pump water down. 1 million gallons of water per well is not unusual. You pump it down under extremely high pressure, and what it does is it breaks the rock, called shale. Then you stop injecting the high-pressure water after the rock is fractured, and you wait for the gas and the oil to blast their way out and come up where the water went down.
So it's a very, very water-intensive process.
Exactly.
Now, is this in a state where, I mean, water is scarce? We talk about water continually. What's the phrase? Whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting over. Is this a quantity of water where that amount of water is in competition with water we use for residential and commercial use and agriculture and things like that?
Of course it is, yes. It's controversial as to whether it's a good idea or economical to reclaim the water, at least for drinking purposes. A rule of thumb is if you add 20% to the drilling cost, you can get pure water back.
What do you think about that?
Oh, I think it's a fine idea. In a previous business I had, we built equipment for monitoring the cleanliness of water, such as in public water supplies. So I know we don't have a lot of it, and I know that you can purify almost any water to any degree you want.
Of course, that's always an economic issue.
Yes. But there's no reason why you can't recover virtually all of the water.
So what are the dangers of fracking? It's so controversial. why are people so against, why are so many people so much against it, and it's actually been banned in many municipalities and a few states?
The reason is that, or the major reason that I understand is that the residuals in the water can include nuclear materials. That isn't true here so much in the West, I don't think, but they found it a lot in Pennsylvania. Assorted other minerals that aren't terribly good for you if you don't get them out again, like arsenic and sulfur. And there are schools of thought about the goodness or badness of the chemicals used that go in with the water as to whether they're highly toxic or not. The EPA doesn't seem to think they are, but outside observers disagree with the EPA.
And where do you weigh in on that?
Well, I'm not a public health specialist. I can't say for sure. All I do know is from previous experience in the water industry, as I said before, you can get anything out of the water you want to.
We're talking to Larry Killam about fracking, hydraulic fracturing. So one of the things that I found interesting in an article about New Mexico and its oil and gas reserves, New Mexico actually has a higher per capita carbon footprint than the average in this country. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why is that?
You're speaking of the carbon footprint and pollution?
Right.
Yes. One very interesting reason why that might not occur to you right off is that the average New Mexican drives twice as far than somebody else, average U.S. resident, that because of the large size of our state. So
people are commuting from Albuquerque and things like that.
Yes. So that's creating a carbon footprint from the automobile exhaust. Another major reason that's well known in the state is the carbon footprint from the coal-based electrical plants. And they account for, I think it's about 90% of the carbon footprint in New Mexico.
One of the reasons that there is so much focus on natural gas and therefore hydraulic fracturing as a way of getting the gas out of the ground is because so much more natural gas is being used than before for electricity production. Why is that?
Well, precisely for the reason we just discussed is to lower the carbon footprint. Gas has about 40% less carbon footprint than the same thermal amount of coal. A second reason is that gas is becoming cheaper. Right now it's about 20% cheaper than coal for an equivalent thermal unit.
Which I don't think people know that. Everyone kind of thinks coal is a big, dirty, ugly behemoth, but at least it's cheap.
Well, coal is the second cheapest. If you, for example, wind and solar are more expensive than coal, and nuclear is even more expensive still. So, yeah, coal is still a cheap alternative.
Now, what does the big energy picture look like in terms of need? We have an increasing world population, we have an increasing amount of development all over the world, we have ever-increasing needs in the United States, no matter how much we say that we're conserving or want to conserve or try to conserve. And so to actually fill that need, what, in your view, needs to happen?
Well, it's fairly simple. From about now to 2035, which are figures I have readily available here, the world needs to increase its energy production by 37%, about one-third. Now, the greenhouse emissions for that increase in energy will be about 25%. And
if we continue to use the kind of fossil fuels that we're using now, whether it be coal or natural gas or anything else.
Or nuclear.
Yeah.
Anything. We just need that amount more energy.
But I mean the carbon, the amount of carbon putting into that you put into the air will go up that
amount. Yes. And Now, we have to balance that against climate change, which comes from the carbon footprint. And the most recent research that I've seen indicates that we're already past the tipping point in terms of climate change.
So if we take all of this wonderfully available natural gas that's all over the state of New Mexico and all over so many places in the West and indeed in the U.S. out of the ground and put it into the air, yeah, it's a lower carbon footprint per thermal unit than coal, but you're still putting untold tons of carbon dioxide into the air, and it's still creating the greenhouse effect.
Yes, and so that's why, of course, everybody's talking about wind and solar. And the problem with that is that you need more than wind and solar to benefit from their power. You need electrical distribution networks that they're only beginning to talk about.
And energy storage.
These are massive projects equivalent to, say, the interstate highway system. And if you took optimistic estimates of the power available from increased wind and solar, they would only cover the increase of energy the world needs.
So we're actually not getting ahead. We're just keeping up.
We're just spinning our wheels. We're not getting ahead.
So let's go back to fracking for a moment. What are the real, as you see it, dangers of fracking at every step along the way of the fracking process?
I think that the major danger could be careless use of the chemicals that are added to the water. They're not put in high volume, but some of them apparently be quite nasty. They're not all revealed, so we don't know for sure, but that certainly is a big danger. As I said before, the water can be recovered. And, for example, there's an interesting project in southeastern New Mexico to use the wastewater for algae growing, for algae fuel. Because the algae don't care so much about the chemicals.
Biofuels.
Yes. So that, I think, is one danger. The other danger that isn't spoken of so much, but I think should be taken into account very much, is letting our guard down about searching for the ultimate energy sources. In other words, if we get a lot of cheap natural gas for our cars, our trucks, our power plants, and so on, then a lot of people are going to say, well, okay, that problem's gone. I'll go worry about something else.
Yeah, let's wait for the next generation to solve the energy storage problem or the climate problem. But climate problems can't be so easily remediated.
Once you go beyond the tipping point, often you can't go back.
Right. When you look at this, I mean, you've spent your life as an engineer. You've been working in this industry. You see clearly the vast problem of climate change, and you see the vast problem of human beings having an almost insatiable need for energy. What do you think are the best possible directions?
Well, the major studies that I've seen on this in the industry indicate that probably the single best thing that can be done is reducing the use of energy. Sounds like a silly idea, but when you think about it, it's about the easiest thing. In other words, if you have a house insulated, if you can get by with half the size house you have now, do that. If you can drive your car half the distance every year, do that. So reduction in the consumption of energy, it seems to be the biggest answer. Another one that a number of professionals in the field feel is, but it's also very controversial, is nuclear energy.
And it's so expensive.
Well, it doesn't need to be. New technology in nuclear coming along is neither all that expensive nor all that dangerous, but it has a huge emotional baggage to it.
Well, yeah, and nobody has really figured out the problem of nuclear waste.
Well, again, that's overdone. It can be done. There's a book, I'm just looking for the notes on this, written by a physicist at the University of California, Berkeley, Environmental and Energy Solutions for the President, or I think is what it's called, by Dr. Mueller. And he's worked in nuclear energy all his life at the labs there at Berkeley. And he says it's not that big a deal with new technologies, but as I say, it's nobody wants it in their backyard.
We're talking to engineer and entrepreneur Larry Killam about fracking. Now, I've seen a number of documentaries in which people who are, I mean, decidedly against hydraulic fracturing bring out some real problems, like the gas getting into the water supply, turning on their taps, and their taps are getting on, catching on fire. And although this is not the norm, it does happen, and people getting really sick from the kind of toxicity that comes in those areas where they're doing hydraulic fracturing. And of course, the oil companies and gas companies deny that there's any connection, and so on. But I mean, how do you see preventing those problems? Some municipalities, as we as I talked about a little bit earlier, have completely banned it. The entire state of Vermont has banned fracking.
Well, the only thing I can answer to that is increased regulation and sophistication by the regulators in the process. We have problems with other sources of energy that nobody worries about, like coal mines collapsing and miners dying.
Well, mountaintop removal is certainly a big problem.
Yes.
And a big fight.
Exactly. So every one of these alternatives has its problems. Whether the fires coming out of faucets, if indeed they do come from the methane or the natural gas, is a much greater problem than the mountaintops and mine explosions with coal, for example. I don't know. I haven't compared those two on a scale.
Maybe they're just both really bad.
They're both really bad. But people are clamoring for energy. So I guess it's just a price you have to pay. And you have to minimize the damage.
So, I mean, I'm one of those people who wishes for and supports the idea that we could make major breakthroughs in clean energy and energy storage and not have to pull all this stuff out of the ground. But given the current reality, what it looks like is scaling down coal, scaling up natural gas. Is that right?
It's certainly for our lifetimes.
And so what are the, I mean, when you start really ramping up natural gas, what does that mean for a state like New Mexico?
Well, I think that people who are against it should be aware that if it is put off too long, let's say for 3 decades, and then the energy situation is even more critical, then if we exploit the natural gas resources in New Mexico, it may be done under too much of a condition of pressure and panic, and it will be done more carelessly than if we start earlier, do it slowly, keep it carefully managed, build up the withdrawal of natural gas from the ground, then cover it all up so that there's a minimum of residuals.
One of the basic realities of New Mexico politics is that there are oil and gas companies on the one side and environmentalists on the other, and they're continually fighting each other. And what they're really fighting each other is about environmental damage. And the oil and gas industry, for example, has been against the Pitt Rule, which basically required that waste from these mining operations has to be dumped into a lined pit as opposed to being just dumped straight on the ground where it can go into the water supply. That seems like a no-brainer. What can be done, in your view, to make these companies that are not going to vanish overnight into real stewards of the land? Is that possible?
Yes. I don't think it will happen overnight. I think it will partially come from a new generation of managers and engineers in those companies who themselves have more of an environmental conscience. And so I think it's important that we have education on the issues and technology starting from, let's say, the early grades in the schools.
Larry Killam is a retired engineer and high-tech entrepreneur and also fiction author. Do you have a website?
Yes, LarryKillamBooks.com.
And Killam is spelled K-I-L-H-A-M, LarryKillamBooks.com. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Enjoyed being here.